Welcome to the Fourth Age, a Wheel of Time podcast, brought to you by DragonMount.com.
The Wheel of Time is an epic fantasy series that is written by Robert Jordan.
Currently, there are 11 main books in the series and one prequel novel.
Robert Jordan is working on the final book, currently titled A Memory of Light.
And the Fourth Age podcast is dedicated to that series.
To contact us, please visit our website at www.dragonmount.com/podcast.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to episode 21. We do have a full house this week. Joining us first, let me introduce Ben.
Hello, everyone.
And also with us this week is Carrie.
Hi, everyone. Also here with us is Andrew.
Hey, everybody.
Before we get to the final part of the Wheel of Time Journal, our episode this week is going to be about the Eye of the World. Andrew has some Wheel of Time news. Andrew?
Okay, in the news this week, we have Wired Magazine having published a very short story by Robert Jordan. It's under 6 words long. Yes, under 6 words. Here's the intro to that particular article. We'll be brief. Hemingway once wrote a story in just 6 words, that story being "For Sale, Baby Shoes Never Worn," and is said to have called it his best work. So we asked sci-fi, fantasy, and horror writers from the realm of books, TV, and movies, as well as games, to take a shot themselves. This is Robert Jordan's entry. Heaven Falls, details at 11. Can you believe Robert Jordan came in at under 6 words? Dragonmount also says, how about you? If you have a 6-word story, share it with us by replying to this article. That article is on the news page at www.dragonmount.com. And they just say, what interesting thing can you tell us in only a few words?
Robert Jordan being brief is abnormal. It just doesn't seem right. But whenever I read this first, I'll be honest, I didn't think it was a story. I didn't even recognize Heaven Falls details at 11. Kind of sounds like a little, you know, news briefing thing. But I didn't even realize that at first. Whenever the very first thing I thought of was the second series of books that Robert Jordan plans on writing, Infinity of Heaven, details at 11, and 11 being the month of November. That's what I thought. So I instantly expected that we're going to be getting some sort of news about that series. I don't know if that's actually going to happen, but that was the first thing I thought of. So November 1st, I was checking all around the internet trying to find some sort of details on Infinity of Heaven.
Hmm.
Yeah, I thought the same thing. But then I thought, I remember him saying that, I think it was in his blog that he posted that he wouldn't write any more books. I think he even said prologues and such until A Memory of Light was finished. And why would he be giving us information on a whole new series that has nothing to do with the Wheel of Time? Because I thought it had something to do with that, too. It also could just be something silly, like, you know, something big happens in the news, and then, you know, they say, oh, this big thing happens. They don't really give you details, and they just news 11.
Yeah.
I don't know.
It's true. That was what I thought first. I actually replied to this short story. Mine was, Memory Forgotten? Finish series first, please. Talking about Memory of Light.
Yeah, that's a good one.
So some other notable mentions from that article. William Shatner submitted one, interestingly enough, and his was failed SAT, lost scholarship, invented rocket. Someone suggested that I do a William Shatner impression, and that's that's not going to happen. But anyway, so we have we have Josh Whedon also. He created Firefly and Buffy the Vampire Slayer. His submission was gown removed carelessly, head less so. And now Stan Lee also, who is a creator writer for comic books, most notably he actually created Spider-Man. His was, and I feel him when he says this, automobile warranty expires, so does engine.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Very weird.
It's interesting. I mean,
the only thing I know, just because I'm a fan, is I didn't notice it before until you just said it, but Joss's name is Joss, J-O-S-S, not Josh. Everybody thinks it's Josh, but it's Joss. but not like anybody that's listening cares, but because I'm a fan, I just had to say that.
Just thinking and one thing that really stands out to me is most everyone, including Robert Jordan's submission. It's kind of funny, you know, it gets you to think, but it, not to put an insult to anyone that did make a submission, Hemingway's For Sale Baby Shoes Never Worn. When I think of that, your eyes kind of unfocus and you're really thinking about it. And it's really sad. It's really powerful. I think that's what the article is getting to. That, you know, at Hemingway, one of his best works were so simple.
Yeah.
If that makes any sense at all.
No, that was one of Hemingway's trademarks. He was always very, very brief. He didn't give a lot of elaborate detail, but he was, you know, he did it well. He let you figure it out on your own, and did a good job.
Welcome to Jason's Wheel of Time Journal. I'm going to be finishing up this week The Eye of the World, chapters 50 through 30. And believe it or not, there are only four chapters, but it's going to be a long one. So if I take some breaks, I'm just getting a drink because it's going to be long. But we want to finish it up this week. So this part, it's actually going to contain no spoilers unless you have not read book one yet. So listen on. We left off, which seems like so long ago. We left off with Moiraine, Lon, Rand, Matt, Perrin, Egwene, Nynaeve, and Loial. They all meet up with the Green Man. The Green Man brings them to the Eye of the World. They all go in, except for the Green Man. Inside the Eye of the World, Moiraine tells everyone about the Eye, that it has the power to either break open the seals of the Dark One's prison or to break it open. Interestingly enough about that, I think that's going to have something to do with the last battle, since if this thing has the power to break open the seal, or to break open the seals, or, you know, break the Dark One out, well, then it has the power to seal him back in. So I think it's going to be part of the last book, but that's just one thought, and probably just one of 1,000 things that are going to be part of the last book. The Eye of the World is the pure essence of Sidheen. That is where Sidheen is centered. When they leave, when they walk out and they have the discussion, they actually meet up with the first two Forsaken besides Ishmael, Angnor and Balthamel. They're both there. This is one of my favorite parts because the Forsaken are so nasty. Agenor is described as wearing a green cloak, and his voice sounds like Balzamon. Balthamel is wearing a dark gray cloak and has a laughing mask on, almost like it's just this leather thing, and that's actually what his face is. Agenor tells him that they can now walk free, not just like Ishmael can. Agenor talks about Nynaeve. Lon gets really pissed off and lunges at him, to be quite honest. And Lon gets tossed aside like a fly, so that's just showing how much power the Forsaken really do have. Of course, when Nynaeve sees that, she does the same thing, and he grabs her. The quote is, "I have nearly forgotten the pleasures of the flesh, but Balthamel remembers much." This, again, it just shows how evil they are. He's basically talking about how Balthamel's going to rape her. I mean, it's disgusting. It's the most vile thing that the Forsaken to do, and believe it or not, this is not the last time that this topic comes up. At this point, the Green Man tells them both to leave, and he and Balthamel get into a bit of a tussle. The Green Man ends up getting burned, and Balthamel withers and dies, so they both kind of kill each other off. This really was a cheering moment for me when I was reading the first book, the first and second, and now the third time. Moiraine starts to fight with Angnor and tries to slow him down. Now, at this point is when everyone runs. Moiraine's actually kind of trying to save him, which is pretty brave on her part. Anyway, we find out that Angnor actually starts following Rand in the next chapter. And Rand sees a white rope attached to Angnor after they have a little bit of a conversation. And Rand starts to draw on that himself. Angnor, I believe he gets kind of jealous, and he fights Rand for it and ends up actually burning himself out and bursting into flames. Rand wants to get away, just away from everything, and he actually finds himself at Tarwyn's Gap, which is a funny thing and one of the start to one of the biggest mysteries of the Wheel of Time. Rand slams the ground, and he kills the Trollocs, and then he kills the Drakkar up in the sky with lightning. The mystery I was talking about is Rand hears a voice in his head, and this is the only time he ever hears this specific voice talking to him in this way, and I'll quote it. "It is not here. I will not take part. Only the Chosen One can do what must be done, if he will." It's in all capital letters, and it's the only time in the series when we see that. Rand responds with the question where, and the voice answers in capital letters again, not here. There are a lot of theories that this voice is the creator, and as I said, so far in none of the books has this been explained at all. Has this been confirmed that it is the creator, if it was something else? Moving on, Rand sees stairs, and he climbs the stairs, and he finds himself in the room with Balzamon, as we know from all the dreams that him, Matt, and Perrin, they're in this room with a fireplace. Rand actually, he's in the room with Balzamon, who is tempting him. Now, he shows him pictures of three people, Nynaeve, Egwene, and his mother. Nynaeve and Egwene kind of fade away, and his mother remains. I think this is kind of symbolic that out of the three of them, that's the one that he's most interested in. Whether that's true or not, who's to say? Anyway, she begs Rand to save her, and the Fates start torturing her. This is when Rand draws a sword of fire made out of the pure fire. Made out of the pure power, I should say, and he frees her. Balzamon offers to teach Rand. I think this was a last-ditch effort, knowing that Rand was more powerful than he really thought he was. Rand promptly turns and cuts the black cord that was attached to Balzamon, and Balzamon ends up bursting into flames and is gone. Rand wrongly assumes that he's dead. After that, Rand wakes up with a fever, and Egwene, Nynaeve, and Moiraine are by where the Green Man died. There's a great big oak tree there now. Rand tells Moiraine that he killed the Dark One and explains everything that happened. Moiraine suspected Rand was the one out of the three of them, Rand, Matt, and Perrin, that could channel, and that he was the Dragon Reborn. She doesn't say that there. They agree that only the people there should know, including Lon, who isn't there, but of course he's going to know if Moiraine knows. Matt, Perrin, Lon, and Loial, they come out of the cave, and they're actually carrying a big trunk with the Horn of Valyr in it, which Moiraine knows how to open. They also have the dragon banner and one of the seals to the Dark One's prison. Moiraine wants to take the horn to Ilion. The Green Man's garden starts to die. So it's symbolic to me, the Green Man's garden starts to die. And actually in the next chapter, when they're going through the Blight, that's actually starting to die down and ease down a little bit too. Once they get to Faldara and they find out that Tarwin's Gap was a victory, it's kind of bittersweet for Rand because he kind of feels, it doesn't say so in the book, but he was the reason why Tarwin's Gap was a victory. And actually, Angmar tells Rand that he saw Rand channeling. Ingtar is mad because he missed the battle. That was because of Ingtar's role in the next book that actually is a little bit prominent. Moiraine asks for an escort to Ilion. That's where she wants to take the Horn of Valyr. Moving on almost to the end, several days later, this is the last chapter. Lon and Rand are practicing swords. And Rand tells Lon that he intends to go away. He's not going to touch the power again. He's just going to go away and ignore everything. Moiraine's ignoring Rand. He feels kind of shut out. Egwene offers Rand to go to Tar Valon, but of course he's not going to go. I mean, he refuses. And he does quote, and he says, "Not if I have to cut my hand off first will he go there." So the final words in the book actually are the prophecies will be fulfilled. The dragon is reborn, and that's what Moiraine says. Thanks very much to encyclopedia-watt.org for providing most of the background information for that. What do you guys think?
Oh, there's so much information.
I know, I'm tired out.
I think that a lot of what happened at the end towards the battle and everything was very confusing for me. There were some things that just seemed to like whiz by and didn't grasp the whole sense of it. Like you were saying about the seals or the seals in the Dark One's prison can be broken by the Eye of the World, or that could have something to do with the last battle. I'm not sure if I just was, because I was listening to it and maybe I was just tired or whatnot, but didn't it say something like now that whole power was destroyed, it couldn't be used anymore?
Oh, yeah, it seemed to me like it was dried up, because they went back down, and after, in the place where Sidene was, that was where they found the chest, right?
Yeah, and they said something about it, but I can't remember. But I got the impression it couldn't be used anymore.
They also talked about... they talked about how no one knew how to make it again, how to make that pure essence of Sidene. Maybe if you're right, I mean, the Eye of the World is gone, but maybe if they figured out again how to make another Eye of the World, mm-hmm. that could be part of the last book that's how they actually end up sealing the Boar.
Because when it was explained, it did sound, when you read it again, it sounded like, wow, they could win if they do that. You know?
Right.
And then when it was
that's the feeling I got when I was when I was reading what Moiraine was saying.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the feeling that I got, that this was like the key to everything.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which I guess is very important now that they've... This is a spoiler, by the way, so spoiler warning. where in book 9, whenever they clean the source, whenever they do that, it was important that they do that in order... It's sort of like a prerequisite to be able to fight the last battle.
Yeah.
Because if it was tainted, it wouldn't be, you know, the pure essence or whatnot.
They wouldn't be able to create another Eye of the World if it was tainted.
Yeah.
It's true. Yeah.
I never thought of that. I was just thinking of, obviously, women wouldn't want to link with men that were going to go mad, and that's when they do their best things together. But yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
So is it possible to create the essence of Sidar as well as Sidine? I don't know.
Or the essence of the true power.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know. I mean, if you could do one, why can't you do all of them somehow?
That would seem to follow logically that if you can create one, you can create the other, but we haven't seen that. But I guess that would make sense because none of the women were there in the strike at Shale Ghul. It was just men, so it would make sense that there wouldn't be a Sidar.
Yeah. But you must be able to make it.
I'm certain you can make it. Sure you can. It's just that it's never been tried. There probably is not very many women that know how to do it.
Well, no, maybe Semirog can be used for something like that. You know, they have Semirog now, and if it's not some kind of trap or plot, like in her way to get caught, then maybe they could do something, some torture or something. No, I can't see them actually doing much torture, but something to make her talk, and maybe she can...
Well, Cad's winking at it.
Yeah, she can explain. Maybe she can help them. Well, not like she would be helping, but give them information about creating something like that. Now that they have her. Maybe they could put one of those, the Adam on her, like they did on Mogideon, and then just make her tell them whatever they want. If they think of it.
It's true. What do you think, Andrew?
Not exactly sure. I was actually kind of thinking back on just the book itself and whatnot, and book one, rather, and just thinking about how really it was those last few chapters that really clenched it for me. While the rest of the book drew me in, I think if it hadn't had those kind of last few chapters there, I might not have continued with the series. And, you know, they just really, the last few chapters are really powerful enough that, you know, I really got into it, and it was like, this is something I want to stick with. So I'm really kind of glad I got the experience and that I actually managed to stick through everything, because I've got a wonderful series that, you know, can't wait for the end of.
Yeah.
Hey, what do you guys think about those capital letters? I thought that was absolutely fascinating. The only other time we see capital letters in the books is whenever the Dark Ones speaking to Daemondred, right? In the beginning of book 6. So it's obviously someone of a whole lot of power. Who do you guys think it is? I honestly have no idea who it is. I think it was probably, I don't know. I'm going to say Luz Theron, but I don't understand why it's capital letters. Any theories?
Well, I don't think Luz Theron would call Rand the Chosen One.
I guess that's true, because he is the Chosen One.
Because he is the original dragon, so he was the Chosen One at one point. But I don't know if it's...
Would it actually be the creator?
Do you know, I don't have my book, so I can't read that part. But he hears a voice in his head, and it says, it is not here, I will take no part. It is not here.
Yeah,
what is he saying? It, like, it is not here where the battle will be done? Is that what he's saying?
Well, see, here's the thing. In the book, even if you read the whole chapter again, it doesn't make any more sense than just reading the quote itself, because it is not here. Well, what is not here? And he says this when Rand actually teleports himself to Tarwyn's Gap, right after he kills the Trollocs and he's throwing lightning around. I mean, this is when he hears this voice in his head, and the voice is, quote, "It is not here. I will not take part." What is not here? You know, what will not take part in?
Well, I was just going to say, I think that's mm-hmm. the response to Rand's question. Rand's saying, hey, this has got to end. He's going to, like, you know, go on. And it sounds to me like he's going to charge Sail Ghul and try and fight the last battle right here and now. And then he's getting a voice saying, hey, you can't fight the last battle now. I will take no part. That could be the Dark One saying.
That's what I was thinking. I will take no part. Like, he's saying, well, you can fight all you want, but I'm not. Because he's not ready yet, he's not going to. Rand, he knows Rand doesn't know anything about what has to be done at the last battle. He doesn't know anything about breaking the seals, or if that's even correct. Mm-hmm. Or he knows nothing at this point. So he knows, even if he does, that if he doesn't take any part in it, that nothing's going to happen. Like, what could happen?
Yeah. It's really a cryptic. It's really a cryptic part of the book, and like I said, it's not mentioned anywhere else in the books at all whose voice that was. There's no clues at all, as far as I've read. No clues at all to who that was. No clues at all what these two people are talking about. Just that it happens.
Yeah, it's almost coincidental that Rand is screaming. I mean, the line right before the capital letters begin is, "The light blinds you, Balazam, and this has to end," being Rand. And then just out of nowhere, these capital letters appear saying, "It is not here." And it points out that it's not Rand's thought, but it makes his skull vibrate much in that same way that the Dark One's voice does. But then the capital letters say, "I will take no part. Only the Chosen One can do what must be done, if he will." And then Rand continues with, "Where?" He did not want to say it, but he could not stop himself. "Where?" And then it just, and suddenly then you get the idea of the haze surrounding him parted, leaving a dome of clear, clean air 10 spans high, walled by billowing smoke and dust. Steps rose before him, standing alone and unsupported, stretching up into the murk that obscured the sun. "Not here," being the capital letters again. And then that's the pretty much end of that particular passage, and Rand heads up into the stairs, and that's where he confronts. Yeah,
and it does seem kind of like it could be the creator, because of the whole part of only the Chosen One can do what must be done. Sounds like something Obi-Wan would be saying or something. I don't know. It just reminds me of that. But it's so
well. It could be like the Dark One saying it, and then
because the Dark One knows that it's the wheel of time, the Dark One's not gonna go around, and it's gonna happen.
Yeah. So maybe the last battle will be involving, you know, the Nablus as sort of his representative versus, I don't know, versus the dragon.
It does seem kind of evil, too, because it's only the Chosen One can do what must be done. And then the second part of that is, if he will, kind of seems like whoever's actually saying this is kind of goading Rand into being what Rand doesn't want to be, if he will. I mean, if you tell someone, you know, "Don't do this," they're going to think about doing it. You know, and if you say, "If he will," Rand is thinking, "Well, maybe I will," you know?
Yeah. But somebody good, like the creator, somebody, but some essence, or if it was the creator, could also be saying that, like, you know, "If he will," like, to try and get him to think of what is right.
Get him
like
to smarten
up.
What
you should do. What you need to do to save people. If you have the courage to go through with it, it's your choice, basically.
That's true. Here's the thing. It says, "Not here. I will take no part." The implication to me is he's not going to take part here. At a later time and date, maybe I will participate
in whatever
this battle is, but it's just not going to be here. And then Rand even, you know, goes further. Hey, okay, so when? Where will this thing be? And all he gets is, "Not here." So to me, it indicates a promise of some future. Whoever is speaking in this thing is going to be taking part in the last battle, at least from what I understand.
So then you would assume it's the Dark One. I guess we could probably go on and on forever. And I bet everybody in the fandom does, because there is no evidence. I guess it's just more of a personal how you think of it. And maybe at some point there is evidence, or maybe Robert Jordan thinks that he's given us enough evidence, but I don't really see an end to either theory.
Welcome to Carrie's Fan Feedback of the Week.
I have an email, and it's about Taryn Grailwell, and I'd like to thank Levi for sending this in. And this is what Levi writes. Hey guys, I just thought I'd send in a question. If a woman is cut off from Sadar, could she hypothetically still reach for Sadar through a Sadar well, Taryn Grail? He says in brackets, I believe Cad Swain has a Taryn Grail set that acts as a well. Unquote. Question mark. Thanks, and keep up the great work, Levi. And yes, Cad Swain does have a well. Was that book 9 when we were introduced to that? When they were in, was it Faramad?
Yeah, whatever they were.
Were they? Yeah. I get confused on which book was which, but
Yep, it was 9.
I can't remember the exact way wells work, but if somebody who was cut off from Sadar could get into it, I know that they could still sense it, but they can't touch it. But then I also think there's probably no way, just like any normal person who cannot channel would not be able to use it. But even though I realize that normal person cannot sense Sadar, I don't think they can. I'm sure they would have thought of
that. Yeah, I don't think they could either. Because whenever Swan and Liana were being tested by Nynaeve in book 6 and I think some in 7, but especially in 6, whenever they were working with Mogideon, Nynaeve actually put the bracelet on Swan and Liana, and neither of them could get Mogideon to cooperate, which basically means just because if you're cut off or severed or whatever, you can't use Taryn Grial, and that's what the well is. It is a Taryn Grial, so they wouldn't be able to utilize it without the ability to channel. If they were shielded, then they would probably be able to use it, but not if they were severed.
The way I always think of it, and the way I think of it, and this might seem way out there, but this is just how my brain works. They can still sense the power. So I liken it to, did you ever take a 9-volt battery and put your fingers on it and you don't feel a shock? But have you ever taken it and put it on your tongue? I don't suggest anyone do this, but if you do, you get kind of a little shock. But if you just take it and it's not wet, it's dry, if you just put it on your arm or something, I mean, you don't get a shock. So I think when you're cut off from the source, it's kind of just like taking a 9-volt battery and putting it on your arm. There's nothing there. But if you've ever felt the shock before, you can feel like, oh, well, maybe I'm going to get shocked. And you can kind of feel it, even though you know you're not getting shocked. So I liken that to being cut off from the source. And even at, I think they can sense it. They just can't touch it. There's no connection there. There's no, they have no way to actually touch like the electricity. They have no way to touch the power. It's cut off from them. There's no, there's nothing in the middle there to get them to that point.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Yeah, exactly. What do you think, Andrew?
I got the I have the idea, kind of the just if it were in the Age of Legends, there were standing flows that basically let almost everybody in the world use any Taryn Grial. It's something that's mentioned, I think, briefly in book 10, I think, something like that. But in order to use most Taryn Grial now, you have to have the connection to the source, unless it's one that specifically will work for anyone, even someone who can't channel.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think the wells work like that, because I think you have to have some connection to the source that is active in order to be able to dip into the well. Now, whether or not that would work on someone who's shielded, I can't say, because, well, we just have no evidence for it, but I pretty much think that it would, you know, for someone who has been severed, it probably wouldn't work. They could probably look at it and go, that's nice. It's a piece of jewelry for me. And then they'd be reminded that they can't channel anymore and they'd be all weepy and mopey.
Yeah. True. True. I hope we answered your question. we might not be completely correct, but we seem to all be of one mind anyway.
Yeah, it seems to be a general consensus. Afraid not. But it is a good theory, and I like good theories. And I think this would be an excellent transition to a crazy theory.
Welcome to Ben's Crazy Theory of the Week.
All right, I've got a pretty quick crazy theory this week. It's not all that, it's not all that specific. Want to say a big thank you from, I guess we could call this guy Andrew Number Two, since we already have one Andrew that's talking here on our podcast. So thank you to Andrew Number Two from Buffalo, New York. Sent this email in to me. He was emailing about Massima, the guy who is the prophet. We saw him a lot in, did we see him in book one? I think we saw him in book one. Saw him a lot in two. He was in three. He was sort of an ally of Rand. You know, a Shinaran and a pretty steadfast guy, turned into a crazy nut job and became the prophet and started doing all this stuff. Well, his theory is about Mesaana, and he thinks that because he spent so much time with the Dragon Reborn, and because the Dragon Reborn is a little crazy, hearing some voice in his head, that Massima sort of caught the crazy bug, that Rand sort of rubbed off on him, and that this is going to continue to happen, that some of the symptoms have been repressed, but maybe he thinks the systems, he didn't say this, but it could be that the symptoms were repressed because Rand was there around them at the time. But he says that the madness that Rand rubs off on people are going to come back, and that especially during the last battle, now that Rand's been gone from so many people for so long, that there's going to be a spread of madness into normal people. You know, normally it's just the men who can channel that go mad because of the taint, but he thinks that Rand and his Taviran-ness is rubbing off madness on people that spend much time with him. So that's his theory. I disagree with the theory. I don't think that he uses an example as Taim, as you know, started to get a little crazy because Rand wasn't with him constantly. You know, he wasn't around. He was with Rand a lot, but then he went off and did his own thing with the Black Tower. But I think Taim has always been crazy. He's a dark friend. I think it's pretty clear. The book says that. And I don't think that simply hanging around Rand, that the Taviran really works like that. Taviran bends chance and, you know, changes the world, you know, forces the pattern to conform to you. It doesn't really seem to be rubbing off on people and making your craziness become a part of you. If that happened, then we'd probably see something like that from Matt and Perrin. Same with Elaine, Egwene, and Nynaeve. Same with Lon. We're not seeing any of that, really. So I don't think it's a good theory, very solid theory, but creative nonetheless.
You know, if it's Rand spending time with people, the person that I would think would be the craziest, if that were true, would be Min. He's with Min all the time. And I don't...
Yeah.
And Min is so completely opposite of crazy. In my sight, she just seems... there's no way.
Yeah, she's studying all those principles
of
logic.
She's always with him.
Yeah.
The most. To me, it seems like she spends the most time with him out of everybody.
Massima also... one of the things that makes him so crazy is he really has not spent a lot of time with Rand at all. In the first book, he was very arrogant, very suspicious, even trying to get Rand in trouble at some point.
Yeah, he didn't even like him.
Right, he didn't even like him. And then all of a sudden, you know, he just went into this, you know, just like something snapped in his brain. And then all of a sudden, he was all gung-ho about the Dragon Reborn. So he really didn't spend all that much time with Rand, so I don't really think there's a direct correlation there.
Yeah. To me, Massima seems more a fan of the Dragon Reborn than Rand. You know, he doesn't like Rand. He likes the Dragon Reborn. He likes the idea of him. And he's just a nut job.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, honestly, I see him as being one of those crazy guys who stands on the street corner with the sign that says the end is coming. And I think that's what it is. I think Mishima sees the last battle as an essential an end of the world, and therefore it unhinged him completely, and he's just like, oh, you know, the dragon is coming again, praise be to the light, and you know, everything's going to end unless you come to the Lord Dragon. And so I really do. I see him being just kind of this rather insane lunatic that just preaches based on the fact that his mind went away.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think he has anybody to blame but his own, like, possibly genetics, I guess, but just his own crazy brain. Like, I don't think there's any outside influence on him being crazy.
Let's spend some time. Thanks for the crazy theory, Ben. Let's spend some time on book one. I have a couple of questions that a lot of people like to discuss about book one, and then that I want to know too. I'll answer the first one. My first question is, what do you remember most about the first book? When I think back on the first book after reading it, when looking at the whole series in relation to the first book, I really feel like book number one, there's a lot of things that happen very quickly. It almost seems like a blur. That so many different things happen. You're introduced to so many different characters. And I think that in a lot of ways, just like a bookend, you have one matching one on one side, you have another matching on the other side. I think the last book is going to be very similar to the first book in a lot of reasons, in that in the first book there's a lot of beginnings that happen very quickly, specifically at the beginning of the first book and at the end of the first book. It's kind of like in that book alone, the bookends are so many different things happen. In the last book, I think there's going to be a lot of endings and a lot of people leaving very quickly and almost takes you aback at how quick it's going to happen. I really feel that it's just kind of like a mirror. What do you guys think when you think about book one?
That's a good comparison. I like that. I think mostly when I look back and I think about reading not only just the first book, it is also the earlier books that follow it, but it's just that it's so interesting to see the character development from, like, the main, like, I guess call them the kids, like Rand, Egwene, Matt, and Perrin. Like, they're so innocent and naive in the eye of the world when we first meet them. And even through, like I said, some of the books that come just after it. And then to see how they are, where Egwene has all this weight on her shoulders, and she is so good at everything that she's been doing lately, like in book 11, and then you can't even compare Rand, because it's just like a completely different person. Matt and Perrin both have changed, maybe not to the same degree, but so much from what they started out as. It's almost hard to think that they're the same people. That, I mean, they are, but it's just like night and day for some of them. I like seeing that, like how innocent they were then, and they would never think about people just coming and hurting them or things that have happened to them. They would have never dreamed of those things.
Yeah, it's true. The word I think of the most with the first book is running, because they are constantly running. They're constantly moving from place to place. They're being pursued, and it almost reminds me of the movie Speed, wherever there's constantly, you know, got to keep moving, because whenever they settle down, they get caught again, and how they go away from Moraine, come back to Moraine, and just the journey that they take, it's not really a journey, it's a fevered, frenzied sprint for their lives, you know, and, you know, the panic and the fear that they are constantly facing was really, really cool to me, because it was so, you know, it was tangible. It wasn't just, you know, okay, we know that this is bad, so we're going to go away. You know, it's, oh my gosh, they're coming. Oh crap.
Yeah.
You know, they really didn't expect to live. Some of them, you know. So that was after that, you know, they sort of like, okay, we've survived this. We've done this before. Now we just have to figure out how to get through this. You know, the first book was like, oh my gosh, we're going to die. I don't know what we're doing. You know, they're so defenseless. Moraine and Lon are their only protection against those Trollocs. So that was the biggest thing that stuck out to me, is how defenseless they were and how they were constantly running.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. There's like you said, there's so much in book one. I think for me, there's a number of really emblematic moments that really stick in my brain. The first one being kind of humorous, being put down sword, Nog not hurt, Nog only want to talk. You know, the one Trolloc that we actually do see talking in a human speech was just kind of hilarious. But then that's immediately followed by the creepiness of Rand dragging Tam through the woods at night, not even knowing that he's going to reach Aemonsfield alive. And then there's Moraine's speech, where she talks about the death of Manetherin. And, you know, I just sat there envisioning this slight, you know, pale little woman, you know, telling this story, and all these, you know, villagers seeing it in their field of vision because their imaginations are so caught up, like mine was. And then I remember, you know, just thinking, you know, about the dark oppression of the ways when they went into the ways. And I remembered thinking about, even before that, the first real introduction we get to the White Cloaks, because we get to see them in Bear Lorne a little bit, but the first real introduction we get to them is right after Hopper is killed in the steading, at the abandoned steading, and Perrin and Egwene are taken into the White Cloak camp. And you get to see Jao from Bornhold and Jarrett Byer and a couple of those really, you know, predominant White Cloaks, and how they're treated so harshly. And then we get to the last couple of chapters, and we get the Green Man fighting with Balthamel, and the Green Man getting burned, and as he's dying, he reaches out and he clutches an acorn, and it starts to grow this tiny little tree. Which then, after the battle, as they're getting ready to leave, Loial sees that the blight is starting to consume everything around the Green Man. And he just can't abide by it. And he walks up and he sings to the little sapling that the Green Man was clutching. And it grows into this just immense thing that, you know, won't be consumed by the blight. And it's one of Loial's most powerful moments, in my opinion. He just, you know, he sings, and this tree, you know, he knows from that moment forward that the tree is not going to have the Green Man or the tree that marks his grave. And it was one of those things that just gave me chills, because I could almost imagine just the sound of this tree song, you know, and just feel the power in it. And it was gorgeous in my mind. And then, of course, that it finishes up with that little thing where Rand and Egwene are talking on the parapet, and you just see Moraine sitting there down on her little bed, and that using the little stone to do the eavesdropping technique, and that, and you just see her kind of smile, and she's like, the dragon's been reborn, and you get that kind of, wow, this has just been something else entirely.
Yeah.
Those are the really big moments that I always stick with me every time I read the first book again.
I think with the introduction of the ways too, because the ways always stick in my brain, and whenever I think of them, I think of book one, even though the thing is we were introduced to them and they become such a big part of some of the later books. They, you know, they get used in different ways throughout the books, throughout the series. But I just always think of the introduction when we first were introduced to them, and they go through the ways, and it's so creepy, and I don't know, it's just it's important. It's an important part of the whole series because of all the things that follow that have to do with the ways. So
a big theme of the first book is courage and how they had the courage to go through with it, and they didn't want to sacrifice anything. Nobody wanted to sacrifice anything. They were willing to, you know, their courage really rose up, and it shows in all the characters. And in my mind, I feel like the last book, they still have their courage, but I think they're going to turn their courage into sacrifice in the last book. And I think that's going to be a nice big circle. You go from courage, and then you go all the way around, and they take this big long trek, and at the end of the road, their courage turns to resignment, and that they're going to have to sacrifice some things in order to get done what the ultimate goal is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What when you think back on the book and in relation to the books that follow, what surprises you? What did you think that something is definitely going to happen and then it doesn't, something else does? So what surprises you?
Well, I never would have in a million years thought I'd be reading a series where there's like a quadruple sum going on, like one man and three women. I didn't see that coming. It's not like I have anything against it, but I would have never, ever guessed. I just would never think anything like that. So that was definitely surprising when I realized where it was heading. But, and it took me a while because I just thought he was going to kind of bounce them around a little bit. I didn't think it was going to be that they were all going to end up, you know, like married to him type thing with children and stuff, but that was a shock.
Yeah, I really thought it was, especially in the first book, I thought it was going to be Egwene, you know, introduction from the beginning. It's like, well, of course it's going to be Egwene. I don't care what Min says. Who cares about Min? three women, he's going to go, he's a farm boy. He's not going to go, you know, that bizarre, that eccentric type of personality, having three women. But that was very surprising. But the thing that biggest surprises me is how competent the characters became after, especially in book four. You know, like, that's whenever they really start to, you know, match the Forsaken, you know, power for power, when they really know what they're doing. So the biggest thing that surprised me is how competent they became. You know, they're not constantly running anymore. Reading the first book, like I said earlier, you figure that they're just going to be, you know, jumping from place to place, trying to stay alive. But after that, they became really powerful. So that's what surprised me.
Yeah, what really gets me. I wasn't really surprised that Rand and Perrin kind of changed and got a little harder, and a little, like, the world, the outside world outside of Two Rivers, really seemed to change them. What really did surprise me is that for as much as he's gotten better with battle and, you know, had, you know, his luck increase and whatnot, Matt really hasn't changed. Matt still laughs. Matt still wants, you know, the easy and the quick, not quick, but the easier and more luxurious life. And he really hasn't, I mean, he does his duty, but at the same time, it's not, you know what I'm saying? He's I don't even think I have the words for it. Out of the three of them, you know, Rand's always about, you know, oh, I can't harm women, and I have to be hard, and I have to be strong, and Perrin's always, well, I can talk to wolves, but I only have to do what I have to do. And Matt's like, I just want a drink.
Yeah,
and
he's reluctant. Woman. He wants to do, of course, he's not going to let somebody suffer or something happen. He'll do what's right in the end. But he's not going to just jump out and say, oh, I have to do the honorable thing.
Yeah.
That's why I love him. He's more an everyday guy and just having fun. That's true. He is still very much the same.
What surprises me is the politics. The first book is very action oriented, very character oriented. I never thought after reading the first book and even the second book really that politics would be such a big thing in the later books, in the middle books, the political maneuvering and the great game, or so it's called. So that really surprised me that the books took on that level. It was a great surprise, because that just adds another dimension to the whole series entirely.
Yeah, I never thought of that. That's true. We didn't see anything like that in the beginning. Now we know all kinds of things.
That actually concludes our special episode 21, book 1 podcast. It goes a little long, but we want to dedicate as much time as we can when we finish up each of those books.
Yeah, and as always, we just wanted to say that we love hearing from everybody. If you want to contact us, you can get a hold of us by either emailing us at podcast@dragonmount.com. You could also, if you choose to and you visit the site, can post in our forum. We are under the Fourth Age at www.dragonmount.com/forums. And as you said, if you scroll down through that big long list of forums, somewhere it says Fourth Age, and you can post in there, and we check that regularly as well.
Yeah, also don't forget to call us. Leave us a voicemail, and you can do that at 1-888-333-7690. And also our MySpace webpage, which is www.myspace.com/fourthage. And not only can you post comments there or just check us out, but there's a spot there for you also to send in a voicemail if you're not in the United States to send the voicemail, or if you don't know how to make an MP3, you just click the button and speak in your microphone and away you go. It does everything for you. It's a little button that says send me an audio, and it's right underneath our player that we have there.
All right, and next week we'll be talking about Luke and Slayer. We mentioned it not too long ago, and we're going to go back and wrap up maybe a few of the loose ends we didn't quite get. We're going to conclude our talk about Luke and Slayer. Also, if you have just the most brilliant idea for a podcast, you should tell us what it is. You can email us, as we said before, podcast@dragonmount.com. We'd love to hear your suggestions. If you want us to talk about something, then we would love to do it. Send us some ideas, okay?
Everyone, thanks so much for listening.
Take care, everybody.
Have a good evening.
And walk in the light.
The Fourth Age podcast is brought to you by DragonMount.com. For advertising, please email advertising@dragonmount.com. The Fourth Age music is brought to us by Josh Needleman. You can visit his site at www.scriberocks.com.